This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. In the 1980s, cities like Philadelphia were dealing with an influx of crack cocaine, and many predicted that the children born of addicted mothers were going to face lifelong problems. These so-called crack babies were reportedly doomed to intellectual and social failure, which would cause the crime rate to soar and become a drag on the economy. Back in 1989, our guest neonatologist Hallam Hurt began following 224 babies born in Philadelphia, half exposed to crack in utero, half not exposed. Her findings have surprised even her, that poverty is more harmful to development than drug exposure. Hallam Hurt is a neonatologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Hallam Hurt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, I should say, because we have talked about this on the air before. Also with us is Susan Fitzgerald. She's now an independent journalist, spent many years as a staff writer and editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and over those years has extensively written about Dr. Hurt's research and has been following it since the very beginning. And Susan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both here. And I should say, I do want to turn the clock back to the 1980s. And, we did shows about it. Everyone was talking about this crack epidemic in Philadelphia and in other cities. From your perspective, what were you seeing, I guess, as a neonatologist here in Philadelphia?
Well, in Philadelphia, certainly we were seeing the crack epidemic, with one in six mothers having used crack during pregnancy in a survey we did of 1,000 births in Philadelphia at that time. And we, as everyone else, was very impressed by the studies in animals that showed that there could be devastating effects on blood flow and on the developing brain. So we were also as concerned as the lay public.
And to you, Susan, as someone who covered and has been covering this issue, do you remember your early reporting?
Yeah, I think in the late 1980s, I was covering public health, particularly maternal child health. And if you think back to what the cities were like then, crime, drugs, there was really something going on in the city. It seemed like, real decay. And in my reporting, I started hearing stories from nurses, doctors about these babies coming in. So it all seemed to make sense at the time.
And what were some of the stories that you heard? What were you hearing?
I would hear anecdotal stories about crack mothers abandoning their babies. There were reports in the literature, some just anecdotal, that these babies had tremors, a strange muscle tone, that they didn't make eye contact. There were some reports that maybe they had smaller heads. So one of the major studies was actually in the New England Journal of Medicine. That was in 1985. So as a reporter, we weren't just listening to stories from the nurseries. Mm-hmm. There were things being published in the literature too that lended some support to those stories.
Well, the idea, and I remember those stories, and even in preparation for today's show, rereading some of that, the idea that crack babies were going to be this lost generation.
Well, absolutely. I think that there were many reports, and certainly the vast, vast majority were anecdotal, and they were depicted as little shaking babies with microcephaly, which is a small head, off in corners, and also presented as, I think they said, some reports, inferior human beings, and not only intellectually, but that they would have low affect, would not be curious, little children as they grew up. So there were a host of such reports, again, primarily anecdotal.
And primarily, are we talking largely then about poor children, poor moms? Certainly in Philadelphia, I'm assuming we're talking about African-American moms.
I would say a lot of the studies were coming out of urban centers. I remember being in a nursery in 1990 at the old Medical College of Pennsylvania, and one of the nurses saying that these days in the nursery would be the happiest days of these babies' lives. Mm. And I mean, that's when you think of such a, grand statement, but that's the kind of stories we were hearing as reporters.
That they were doomed.
They were doomed, so their time in the nursery was going to be their happiest time.
But, pregnant moms should not be using crack cocaine or any kind of illegal drugs. They should not be drinking. They should not be smoking. I mean, it's not as if I mean, it seems to make sense to some degree to be worried about the future of these babies.
Oh, there's no question. There's every reason to be worried. And again, when we as researchers look at the animal studies, there would be a decrease in blood flow to the uterus. There was decrease in oxygenation, and the placenta in humans as well was found to separate early, and more preemies were born. And again, it was sort of like the not just cocaine, but it was cigarettes, it's alcohol, it's a chaotic lifestyle, it's sexually transmitted diseases. So this entire sort of package was very concerning.
Now, you did this study where you separated these two groups of babies, I guess in half, mm-hmm. Half of whom were exposed to crack in utero, half of whom were not.
Yes, given what we've just discussed, we were very concerned about the outcome of these children and trying to find out, you know, exactly what might be wrong. Were they going to have malformations? Were they going to have, you know, intellectual delays? So we embarked on this study to attempt to answer some of these questions. And when we did our study, we picked a very particular population. We wanted babies who were term or near term in order to avoid the extreme preemies, and we also wanted babies who had not had birth asphyxia so as not to complicate the findings, whatever they might be. And we also decided that we did not want to use exposed children mothers had only used once or twice. And some studies did look at moms who really had used very infrequently. So in our study, the mothers had to have used at least two trimesters of pregnancy, and the average number of days that they used was 99, which is quite high by the standards of other publications.
And this study, I mean, we're talking about something almost 25 years old. This is a long-term, pretty unusual study, is it not, Susan?
Yes. I mean, as a journalist, I usually don't get the chance to follow an issue so much over so much time. And what really fascinated me was to be able to keep coming back and seeing how are these kids doing, you know, as toddlers, how were they doing as in early elementary school, how were they doing as they entered the teen years. I mean, following a group of kids, I mean, think about all our lives. We move, we change addresses, we drop our landlines and cell phones. And the fact these researchers were able to keep tabs on all these kids for so long, or many of the children for so long, is really something.
Well, even going back, I guess it was a matter of doing tests as these children were growing and developing, doing certain kind of cognitive tests or spatial motor tests, things like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In the study, we looked at regular things like growth and looked at the head circumference and things that had been touted as being, you know, really disastrously deleterious. And we also looked at development and then subsequently many more things. And so the earliest things we did were looking at development using what an instrument called the Bayley Scales of Infant Development, which looks at cognitive and motor progress. And early on, we found as early as about 12 months that the exposed and the non-exposed didn't differ from each other statistically in their performance. And then we also compared their progress to a group of middle-class children and found that while the exposed and non-exposed were not differing from each other, they were beginning to perform quite poorly when compared to a middle-class control.
And this has really been a consistent finding over these years, yes?
Yes, it has absolutely been consistent. And I must say that for those early years, we were so bent on concentrating on trying to find differences, which we absolutely fully anticipated, that I didn't concentrate so much on the fact that this is not a pretty picture. And that has been something that has evolved over the years to the present, where we've seen not differing from each other statistically significantly, but performing poorly when compared to middle class peers and on standardized tests
as well. So when I said in my intro, as I did, that poverty is more harmful to development than drug exposure, I mean, that's a rough thing to say, but those are your findings, right?
They're absolutely our findings. On essentially all the standardized tests, we find that our cohort does not differ significantly between the two, but are performing poorly, and that goes for achievement, cognitive, And also we did many more sort of fine-grained evaluations looking at neurocognitive performance, which is a much more fine-grained evaluation, and also response to stress.
Mm. What's the significance of this, Susan, from your perspective, this overall finding?
Well, I think, the finding that poverty is a bigger factor than drug use, I think that's a really tough finding. I think it's much more simpler to say the drug is the problem.
Sure.
Because hopefully, there would be treatments, there would be prevention. I think poverty being the bottom line, that's very mind-boggling. And after this article, I heard from so many people, and it reinforced to me, I heard from educators, I heard from parents, I heard from former drug users, I heard from policymakers. Poverty touches so many different possible solutions. So I think it's very mind-boggling.
I do too. Go ahead.
And I think arguably it's so much more difficult to change. I mean, when you have one in six women in Philadelphia at the time we did that survey who are using drugs, then as we know, there was this huge outcry against the mothers, and it gave us something to focus on. And in essence, I think that was a lot easier than to focus on this, like the elephant in the room, which was poverty.
But I wonder too, when you look deeper into these parents and these children's lives, did you see the problems of stress? You mentioned that, or even violence, whether inside the house or outside in the community. Did you find sort of similarities in the kind of world and family life that they had beyond the drugs?
Oh, yes. And I think, again, having had the very good fortune to have followed these cohorts over the years, we began to hear stories when the children would come in for testing that were seeing, drug deals or their mother being chased by someone with a knife. And so when we heard these stories, we thought, well, let's try and evaluate what is the degree of violence to which the children are exposed. And so at age 7, we looked at that, and it was really quite startling. And again, there was no difference between exposed and non-exposed, but in their exposure to violence. But as you may have seen, I think 11% of the children had actually seen someone killed.
Right, and we're talking about a 7-year-old here.
Yeah, and again, and in that study, our psychologists were wonderful. You always have to say, this can't be something that your sister or brother told you or you saw on TV. And of course, with a 7-year-old, you can't always promise that everything they say is true. But she would never allow that statement to be made without saying, well, tell me about it. What was it? And then, of course, to try and get the children help if they needed it. And if I could just add...
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. Talking about some groundbreaking research by Hallam Hurt, the voice you just heard, neonatologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Also with us, Susan Fitzgerald, an independent journalist, talking about a long-term study having to do with the children of crack-addicted moms. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents the Richard Thompson Electric Trio, Todd Rundgren, the David Bromberg Quintet, the Mavericks, Asleep at the Wheel, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 15th through 18th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
Fleetwood Mac's Rumours turned Private Pain into one of the best-selling and most celebrated albums of all time. And Lindsey Buckingham knows the songs can't take all the credit.
The appeal was not just musical, and it was pretty unique having two couples that were going through personal turmoil and yet somehow rising above that.
A candid conversation with Lindsey Buckingham today on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Here, now, in the moment.
It's a fast-moving stream of news and information. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are co-hosts for Here and Now, your source for news, updates, and great stories.
In the middle of your day, stay on top of what's happening.
With Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Don't miss a thing.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. A generation ago, a crack cocaine epidemic struck many urban neighborhoods, including here in Philadelphia. Dire predictions that the children of these moms using crack cocaine were going to become a lost generation. And our guest, Hallam Hurt, has been studying these young people as they have grown up and developed. And she found that poverty has been more harmful to their growth and development than even crack cocaine. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And in a couple of minutes, we'll be talking with one of these kids, now grown up and a mom herself. Let me go back to you, because you were describing some of the research on these seven-year-olds. These are the seven-year-olds that were part of your long-term study.
Yes, and we were talking about exposure to violence and how sort of startling it was to us, how much violence they had been exposed to both in the home and in the neighborhood. And in another part of that study, we looked at the children's degree of self-esteem, their anxiety levels and depression, and found that the children that had the highest exposure to violence were different. They had lower self-esteem and were more anxious than those with a lower exposure.
You want to expand on that? Because this is very significant. This is very important for us to try to understand.
I remember I wrote about that piece of Dr. Hurt's research when it came out, and these were seven-year-old kids. And one of the findings was that 19% of those children, seven-year-olds, had seen a dead body outside. And, I mean, that's one in five kids had seen it. And this is not our view of childhood. I mean, our view meaning
a middle-class view, right?
We think of kids, you know, playing around in, you know, the backyard and the playground. And here these kids were seeing dead bodies. I think nearly 85% had seen somebody arrested. And to me, that study really struck at the difficulty of growing up in poverty.
But just even going back to your research, because you were looking at children exposed to crack cocaine in utero and those that weren't, finding that over time, you didn't see much developmental difference between these two groups. These were poor kids growing up in poor neighborhoods in Philadelphia. The difference, though, between them and their middle-class counterparts, pretty dramatic.
It was quite dramatic, and I think probably it really began to dawn on us when we did IQ tests at age four. And we found that the children were performing poorly. Again, no difference between the groups, but below average, below the average IQ of 90 to 110. And when they came in to be tested, again, they were really darling children that we really didn't suspect that the outcome was going to be as concerning. And in that regard, we looked at the children. There were 32 out of 150 we tested that scored average or above, and we thought, while we were very discouraged that overall performance were poor, we thought, let's look at the children who did well. What is happening with them? And I think a really incredibly important finding there was that we went into the homes and did a survey, which is standardized, called the Home Observation Measurement of the Environment, and found that the children with the more nurturing and more cognitively, intellectually stimulating homes did better on the IQ test. So I think that while many of these findings are sad, I had said earlier, I think we should be kind of mad that we have something we can cure. And we found that it wasn't the bricks and mortar, it wasn't the physical environment of the home that made a difference. It was what went on in the home. Did the child have books? Did the family have the artwork displayed? Did they show warmth and affection during the home visit? So there are things that can happen that can improve the outcome.
And even these babies that have been exposed to crack cocaine,
yes,
in utero, that looking at the quality of their relationship with their mom or their dad or whoever.
Exactly. And the extended family, many were in extended families, that it was what went on. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And that particular finding has held up as the children have grown older and become adolescents and young adults. over and over and over again, we find that the early home environment is very predictive of outcome, regardless of exposure.
Right. We'll be talking with one of the now young women who's been part of the study in just a minute or two. But Susan, you've been writing about this, and when you look at some of these adults now, you see kind of a mixed bag, I guess, of results.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, these kids at grown up, if you have your Dr. Hurt did a study where she put up a slide of where these kids are at now, and it is a mixed story. Kids in prison, a lot of babies born to these kids, a few of them married, so it is a mixed story. But again, the story doesn't break along the lines of cocaine exposed or non-cocaine exposed. There's kids struggling on both sides of the equation, and there's kids doing really well on both sides of the equation.
And did you find, going back to you, Halimert, that these mothers continued to use either, if not cocaine, other drugs, or again, sort of a mixed picture as well?
It was a mixed outcome. We did do urine samples on the caregivers throughout the study, and then we began getting them on the participants as well. And some mothers continued, some absolutely did not. So it was a mixed outcome there.
I'm thinking of things like fetal alcohol syndrome. I mean, we know that there have been certainly studies and children born of alcoholic parents that seem to have some pretty potentially serious learning problems. Is that different? I mean, does cocaine interact differently than alcohol?
Well, alcohol definitely has a syndrome named after it, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome. And it can be, as with everything else, there are gradations, and it certainly can be devastating. And in regard to the cocaine, again, we expected, based on all of these studies, to see particular detriments. And I think that, just to hark back to something earlier in the hour, in pregnancy, it can be absolutely deleterious.
Sure.
And there can be fetal loss, there can be increased prematurity, there can be this abruption, this separation of the placenta, and babies can experience birth asphyxia. So there definitely are adverse effects.
And I think, Susan, one of the articles that you wrote said that for a lot of these moms had never had prenatal care on top of all the things we've been
talking
about.
That was a whole other issue going on top of this. So these women were living very chaotic lives at this time in Philadelphia. The healthcare system had a lot of deficiencies. So you had women who were not getting prenatal care. And in some instances, they really were arriving in the hospital to have their baby, having had no doctor checkups.
Well, we're talking about some groundbreaking long-term research that our guest, Dr. Hallam Hurt, has been doing. She's a neonatologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Susan Fitzgerald is now an independent journalist and has been writing about Dr. Hallam's research for many years now and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And this research has been looking at babies born to moms who were using crack cocaine, what has happened to them over time. And joining us now is Jamie Drakewood. She's now a 23-year-old student at Tuskegee University in Alabama, part of this long-term study. Her mom was a crack user. And Jamie Drakewood, it's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So what was it like for you to be part of this study? I realize probably when you were little, you didn't know you were part of a study, but as you got older, what was that experience like for you?
It was actually interesting. It was great because they never treated me like I was in a study. It seemed as though that I was just coming to visit, you know, some old family friends. with the different testing, it was never more like rigorous. It was more fun for me than anything.
Tell us a little bit about your mother, and this is one of the reasons why you were part of this study.
Well, my mom struggled with addiction throughout of my life. Currently, she's clean. She's been clean for, I believe, over 5 years.
Oh, that's great.
But that's something that my family struggled with.
Right.
I went to Girard College, so I wasn't really there a lot at home. But looking in, you would never tell or could tell that my mom suffered from addiction.
Oh, really? I mean, she looked like everybody else's family in a way?
We looked like a regular family. We had a 3-story house. My mom had a great job. She had a great car. I was at Girard College. My sister was at Catholic school. My little brother was in a private school. Huh. Looking inward to my family, you wouldn't know what we were going through.
Was she able, though, to raise you as a mom?
Yes. There was no such thing as not doing what I needed to do as a child. Getting good grades and doing my chores, that was all that I needed to focus on. Even when my mom wasn't capable of taking care of me any longer because she needed to get herself together. Mm-hmm. Even moving out with my sister, it was the same drill. Get good grades, do and handle your business at home with chores and helping out.
Let me get Hallam Hurt back in on the conversation. I know that you know Jamie Drakewood. Mm-hmm. and was her mother unusual when I realize that every parent is, but was she unusual in this study?
Well, I think that this, I'm so happy for Jamie that this was what she experienced in regard to some of these material things and having to go through her mom's addiction. But I think it is the exception, mm-hmm. Definitely in regard to the home visits that we made with all of our participants. And I'm happy that she did have this exception, and she is one of our shining stars, having going now to be a senior, yeah, and to graduate, and so we are thrilled for her and very proud of her inner strength. She's very strong in regard to her feelings for her mom and her sister, but there's also, she, yeah, should be very proud of herself.
And Jamie, I hope you're feeling proud of yourself. Did you, when you were growing up, did you know the extent of your mom's problems? Was that obvious to you, or something that you learned over time?
It wasn't until over time, till I got older, that I was sat down. That my sister actually sat me down and discussed with me exactly what was going on with my mom, because I just figured that my mom was just sick. And she broke it down that my mom does have a sickness, but mommy's sickness is different. Mm-hmm. And instead of being angry, I always felt sorry for my mom. And I knew that eventually she would get back to being, the strong woman that I always know.
So were you raised largely by your sister?
I was with my sister when she was 17, when I was 10, so 10 and on, 10 up until graduation.
So you must have been a good student.
Yeah, there was
no question about that, right?
No question. There was no
choice.
There was not, no coming in, you couldn't come in the house without a good grade. There was no exception.
Well, it's
no other job but school. So.
But to take care of school. And was it helpful to be at Girard College here in Philly?
I left Girard College after my 9th grade year, because I wanted to be closer to home. Girard College has helped me. A lot of people from Girard College has helped me, through my growing up process, because they have a dorm, they have dorm mothers and dorm fathers. That maternal figure I never was lax about in my life. So I didn't have to yearn so much for that figure. And because I was around my friends a lot, whatever, I didn't really have to dwell on what was going on at home. When I was at school, I can deal with school life until I went back at home.
Well, since you're nodding your head, Hallam Hurt, I mean, we were talking about the importance of relationships, these children's relationships with either their parents or important adults in their lives.
Yes, once again, I think it comes to this home environment, and Jamie certainly experienced a variety. But I think whatever it is that can happen in a home that is nurturing, regardless of who provides it, can be, any relative, grandmoms, and also sometimes they're very strong, uncles and aunts that are part of children's lives. And that seems to be the linchpin.
Jamie, if I can ask you, one of the things that we were talking about, and this is going back to Dr. Hurt's research, and you've been a part of this research, is that for a lot of these young people growing up, they saw a lot of violence. They saw dead bodies. They heard gunshots. They saw people being murdered. Did you see things like that?
I've heard gunshots. I've never seen a dead body. I've seen things that people my age should not have seen. I witnessed things that people my age should have witnessed. Mm-hmm. But the great thing about it was I had somebody that I can talk to.
Right.
That I didn't feel like that I had to sugarcoat anything to. My sister. It was my go-to person. Anything that I needed to talk about or say, that was who I went to. So I think that helped me out a lot within my life.
Sure. I mean, not knowing that you weren't alone, and if you saw something that upset you, that you, as you said, you didn't want to see, you had someone you could talk it over with.
Exactly.
Yeah. And how did you get to Tuskegee, the famous Tuskegee University?
For the longest, I thought, well, my sister wanted me to go to Spelman.
Okay.
I wanted to go to Howard. and my mentor, Dr. Anthony Driggers, he was a part of a college tour. And the college tour to me was completely different from any other college tours because they handpicked their students and they had different workshops and everything before they actually went on tours. So to me, it was like another challenge that I wanted to be a part of. And me sitting down with him and letting him know what I wanted to do, he told me that there was a school that would be great for me. And once we got to Alabama and I stepped on campus, I knew I was home.
Oh, that's great. Now you're studying, you're a senior this year, studying animal science and business management.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
So how, putting those two together, what are your career plans?
I want to be a food inspector.
Oh, food inspector. And why is that?
Well, currently, I've been a vegetarian for 10 years. And I've visited a lot of production companies and slaughterhouses and things like that.
Whoa.
So, because I'm really picky about what I put in my mouth, especially what I put in my son's mouth, I would like to be picky when it comes to the rest of the world. it's been a lot of things like mad cow disease and other things that pops up that shouldn't pop up because it's easy testing to figure out if food is damaged or not. So I just wanted to be part of the greater good, I guess.
Oh, that's great. And you have a little boy, Kimani, yes?
Yes, I do.
And how old is he?
He's one.
And does he live with you when you go back to college? Is he with you down there?
Yes, we have a house down in Alabama.
And do you see yourself then having a good life?
I see myself having a great life. Of course, I'm young and I struggle a little bit, but I'm not struggling as much as I see other people. I count my blessings and know that I'm not done yet. So,
well, Jamie Drake,
I look forward to seeing what the future holds for me.
Well, me too, and I'm feeling pretty good about it for you. Jamie Drake, well, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
No problem.
And she, again, a child of a mother who was a crack user, part of a group of people studied by our guest Hallam Hurt here. And I should say that Jamie Drakewood is currently a senior at Tuskegee University in Alabama. We're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation with our two in-studio guests, and take calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing Education at PAFA invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels of experience this fall, featuring classes in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, and weekend master workshops with renowned artists, including Vincent Desiderio and Elizabeth Osborne. Registration is now open. Details online at pafa.edu/CE.
I carried a suitcase of money, drug money. Once, 10 years ago.
That's a clip from Orange is the New Black, the new Netflix series. It's based on the memoir by Piper Kerman. On the next Fresh Air, Piper Kerman talks about her year in a minimum security prison and seeing her story turned into television. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Memoirs, we read them all the time. Blue Nights by Joan Didion, Bossy Pants by Tina Fey, and Night by Elie Wiesel. Most memoirs are deeply personal. They enlighten and provoke as truths and half-truths are revealed. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, what memoir writing does for us as a means of self-expression and to help us heal.
Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just a recap, back in the 1980s, 1990s, cities like Philadelphia dealing with an influx of crack cocaine, and many people were predicting that children born to addicted mothers were going to face lifelong problems. They were called crack babies, and their future looked quite uncertain. Well, back in 1989, our guest neonatologist Hallam Hurt began following 224 babies born in Philadelphia half exposed to crack in utero. We just said goodbye to one of those babies, now a 23-year-old girl, Jamie Drakewood, and the other half not exposed to crack. And our guest Hallam Hurt's findings have surprised her, I think surprised a lot of other people, that poverty more harmful to development than even exposure to drugs. And Hallam Hurt, a neonatologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, professor of pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Our other guest, Susan Fitzgerald, has been covering Dr. Hurt's research over these years. She's now an independent journalist. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Susan, we just said goodbye to Jamie Drakewood, and you had gone to her house. You'd met her mom, seen them together. What can you add to that?
Well, you know, I had the privilege of meeting Jamie and her mother, and it really took me back to the early days of the 1980s. We like to think of these crack moms as bad moms. You know, we had good mothers and bad mothers. And when Jamie's mother told her story, it really did sound like a bad mother. She was on an all-night cocaine binge when she went into labor, you know, arrives in the hospital and just is very grateful that her daughter is born with 10 toes and 10 fingers. But, you know, the Karen, the mother I met, she was a strong woman. She was a loving mother, a loving grandmother, and she set really high standards for her three children. So it just was a reminder to me that most people are far more complex. You can't really put them in a box one way or the other.
You want to add to that, Hallam Hurt?
I agree completely, and I think that the bond between the biologic mom and her children is incredibly strong, and through good and through bad, and that feeling is there. And it's certainly in this particular instance, Karen offered her children a great deal while still going through major problems herself.
But what we heard from Jamie is, and what you said, Susan, is this was a mother. I mean, in spite of her addiction, setting high standards, there was absolute expectations you were going to bring home, you know, good work, and obviously plans for a future, plans for college.
It's very impressive. And again, I think that we have just a marvelous example of how a young woman has has overcome, you know, the difficulties that with having her mother, quote, be sick, and yet she had her sister as a strong person that she could go to when she saw these things, as she's rather eloquently described, that no one her age should have seen. So I think that the strong figures in the family are incredibly important.
And I think it's important to add that even Karen's recovery, Jamie's mother's recovery, it wasn't instantaneous. Mm. It took place over many, many years. So there was not an easy fix to her drug use.
Well, and if so, if the problem is poverty, I mean, not that addictions are easy to cure or even deal with, but poverty is even bigger. And here we are in Philadelphia with a very high poverty rate. And we know since the Wall Street implosion that the number of people in poverty now has gone up.
Yes, and as we stated earlier, it's a huge problem to fix it, you know, compared really to looking at drug use. And I think we've done a lot of thinking about this, and based on the findings that we have, our feeling is that very, very, very early intervention for parents and infants is critical to improving this situation. And there are a number of studies, and many that are decades old, that show that early intervention has a very long effect. And in the oldest studies, the families who receive that have been shown to have less time in prison, to be more likely to own their own homes. And so I wish I knew the exact magic of
sure.
what it is in early intervention, but that's something we're currently in the process of investigating. But I think that, to me, that no matter your material means, if the families can learn the importance of development to their children and how to interact with the children is what Philadelphia's work should be, or the work of the nation. Right. So I think that the parenting, the early intervention, literacy, reading, those are the things right. that I and while we love charter schools and think they do incredible work, as we know, many times the children spend a year or two, quote, catching up. And our feeling is, why get behind? You know, and that is huge. And while Head Start is a wonderful early Head Start from 0 to 3, gets fewer funds, and I think that that's where we should focus.
Well, and Susan, just a quick question, then we will get to our callers. I mean, nothing that Hallam Hurt said there should be new or shocking or surprising. I mean, I think the frustration is, we know this. We know about early intervention. We know about the importance of the quality of relationship between a parent and a child. Not that it's easy, but we know this stuff.
We know this. We know the value of early education. We know the value of prenatal care. We know the value of parenting. But, I mean, I think parenting is a key issue in this. How do we bring more parent education to the table? That's not something you're taught. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you have naturally.
And if you grow up in a house where maybe it's a little more chaotic and you didn't see, you know, mm-hmm. the examples of good parenting, then how are you going to know this stuff?
Right.
Let me see what looks like Crystal from Schwenksville has to say. Crystal, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm a foster mom, and my husband and I adopted two kids, two boys, out of the Philadelphia DHS system. Both came to us when they were 7 years old, and their stories would curl your hair in terms of neglect and abuse in those first 7 years. And I would really want to ask your guest today, the damage that's done in those first 7 or 8 years by bad parenting, abuse, whatever the issues are, and I put it down to post-traumatic stress, really, for my boys, can you ever undo that? Is it possible to undo the damage that's done in those first few years of really poor, horrific parenting?
Crystal, just a quick question to you before we hear from Hallam Hurt. How old are these children now?
My older son is 30, and he's in jail, has been in jail or juvenile facilities for more than half of his life. And my younger son, who is 26, is also in jail.
Wow.
Both were treated for hyperactivity as children. No one ever sat down and talked about post-traumatic stress with us.
Well, that's it. Well, I appreciate the call, and I'm sorry to hear. And obviously, you put a great deal of effort to try to help these young men. And to Hallam Hurt, that's tragic.
Yeah, it is. And I think the first thing to say is that you're a wonderful person for having taken them in. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And I'm sure you've done absolutely everything that you possibly could. I don't know that I'm the person to answer your question of can you ever erase those hurtful things that occurred very early on. I definitely believe that, when I say I'm not the person to answer from scientific research, but I think anecdotally there's no question that children can get, quote, get better and do well. I feel that that's pretty unequivocal. It seems as if you had a very difficult time since yeah. both of your older, now much older, children are in prison. This is very obviously disappointing, and I know it must be a heartbreak for you. But I definitely, I'm a glass half full person or three quarters full, and so I think that we should not give up, and I think that they can definitely make a better life for themselves.
Crystal, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Susan, she talked about PTSD. I mean, the idea of feeling that, and I think for some kids, you know, it is like living in the middle of a war zone.
I hear this often from teachers, you know, teachers of first and second graders, and they say that these little kids' lives are already just so complicated. You know, multiple moves, multiple caregivers. So obviously, you know, there's stress and anxiety that is already bearing down on kids when they're 5, 6, 7 years old.
And I'm thinking about the sort of the sort of ongoing nature of stress. I mean, how does that affect a child's development if they're in a sort of constant state of vigilance and stress?
Well, that it's becoming increasingly recognized as quite detrimental to the children and to adults. And we do know that children being raised in poverty do have higher stress levels. That's been shown. And it does have effects on, for example, memory.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that type of thing has definitely been shown. So it's a burgeoning area for continued investigation.
Impaired memory or
yes.
the difficulty of retaining information or?
Both. And difficulty, like in remembering faces and things like that are associated with stress. But again, for us, we haven't investigated that in this particular cohort in that regard. But we do know that stress is quite harmful.
Yeah, anything you want to add to that, Susan?
I want to just introduce the idea of resilience. There is a lot of research on the question of why do some kids thrive and why do some kids not. And in the case of Jamie, or the young woman that was on air earlier. But it sounds very simplistic, but what the research does show is that every kid, if they have one constant caring adult in their life, that really can make a difference. So I always am very struck by that statement, yeah. That one caring, constant adult who loves a kid unconditionally and holds them to high expectations really can make a difference.
You're nodding your head.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And I think that person may also be found in the church, may be found in neighborhood organizations. Right. And as Jamie had mentioned in our conversation, she had a mentor.
Yes.
And so I think that's an excellent point.
Let me see what looks like Mark from Clinton, New Jersey has to say. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, how you doing, Marty?
Good.
Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
I just wanted to say I wanted to congratulate Jamie from coming from good stock, okay? Obviously, her mother was very capable, okay? Even through her addiction problems, she managed to keep things somewhat stable for her kids, okay? It really must have worked very hard to manage that. And then her sister also showing a whole lot of strength to help support the family. I think that the addiction problem is not who the person is. It's what they're suffering through. And, so, I mean, you know, obviously Jamie comes from good stock, and that I'm really congratulating her for pulling through on that. That's what I wanted to call it.
Well, Mark, that's nice of you to say that, and I guess I'm back to you, Hallam Hurt. I mean, we're back to relationships and grit and resilience.
Yes, she clearly has it. Jamie has it, and I think that while she is one of our star participants, there are many others who are in college and have had, and many are employed. So I think that the strength that they find from the home or this, as we mentioned, another important person in their lives is definitely a very critical aspect of their growing up. Sure. and becoming useful citizens.
Susan, what do you think the lessons are for journalists? And you know, I can't remember that far back, but I'm sure we talked about crack babies on this show, and I'm sure we talked about that, you know, the potential lost generation and some of these dire warnings. What's the lesson for folks like you and me?
Well, I think the lesson is things aren't always as logical or simple as they seem. Perhaps, you know, be more attentive to following the story over time. We know science is built one teeny finding at a time. Even if it's in a prestigious medical journal, the truth could change the next day. And, you know, really coming down to the, again, what I said earlier, people are really complex and can't always be neatly labeled one way or the other. So,
don't get distracted
by the importance of paying attention to the research that's going on out there as journalists.
And don't get distracted by the headlines.
Exactly.
I think I remember.
Because it's easy to, the headlines were really, really appealing on this story. And I think journalists, we all jumped in on it.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, I think I would like to add that I think we in the medical profession jumped on it as well. And I think one of the things that we learned in this study was to follow the data. And I think that's incredibly important. It wasn't very popular, and it isn't very popular actually today. But I think that we were expecting an outcome, and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so it was an awakening, and I think that the importance of equipoise, which is critical to all of us, and for us to try to maintain it. And this is one study, and it's obviously important for every study.
Sure.
Because it would have been very, quote, sexy to have found a lot of things. And sometimes it was hard when people would say, oh, so you're saying it's fine to use cocaine. And of course
you're not.
Of course not. And so I think that's a lesson that we learned.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. Are you continuing to follow these now adults, or is this study concluded?
Well, it's never quite concluded. We have Institutional Review Board approval to remain in contact with these young people on an annual basis, and we're looking forward to that. And they are getting a certificate of having appreciation for having participated for this quarter of a century.
Wow.
And we do hope to maintain contact with them.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us
again
on Radio Times. And that's Hallam Hurt, neonatologist at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Susan Fitzgerald, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's an independent journalist and has been covering the work that our guest has been doing for about 25 years now. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Nick Sessler, the intern for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. Radio Times produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and today, Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.